This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara. This Wednesday, tennis champion Dylan Alcott named Australian of the Year. He's promising to change perceptions. And pioneering female jockey Pam O'Neill named in today's Australia Day honours list. You'll hear her remarkable story.
Sally, it was at the time that I wanted to do it. I really wanted to ride against the men and I couldn't see why we couldn't. It was really like a discrimination against women, you know?
First up today, disability advocates say the appointment of Paralympian Dylan Alcott as Australian of the Year is a big step forward. The wheelchair tennis champion says he's overwhelmed with emotion to receive the accolade in the midst of his campaign for an 8th Australian Open win. But for Dylan Alcott, life is not just about sport. He's promising to use his role to change the attitudes of those without a disability. Isabel Rowe reports.
The 2022 Australian of the Year is Dylan Alcott.
From the tennis court in Melbourne straight to the stage in Canberra. Yesterday was one of the biggest days of Dylan Alcott's life.
OAM is a four-time gold medalist.
And as Australian of the Year, there'll be more work to do.
We have to have greater representation of people with a disability absolutely everywhere. In our boardrooms, in our parliaments, in our mainstream schools, on our dating apps, on our sporting fields, in our universities.
As the first person in a wheelchair to win Australian of the Year, Dylan Alcott wants to improve the lives of people with a disability.
Of those 4.5 million people, only 54% of them are involved in the workforce. Unemployment rate is double that of able-bodied people. We're not just ready to work. We're ready to take your jobs, all right? We are coming. We are coming.
Disability advocate and writer Hannah Diviney watched Dylan Alcott win his semi-final with pride.
I was feeling particularly emotional that I had been able to watch two people who look like me, being disabled, on primetime television with my whole family on a Sunday night because that had never really happened before.
She resonated with his comments about work. Her wheelchair makes it difficult to operate in many places.
For me, working as a freelancer and doing the disability advocacy stuff that I do was a choice I made in part because regular avenues of employment weren't as open to me. The sort of help that I need and the adjustments can be very off-putting for businesses.
Graham Innes AM agrees. When he started his former job as Disability Discrimination Commissioner in 2005, people with a disability were employed at a rate 30% lower than the general population. And that hasn't changed.
We rate people as a society, we rate people based on whether they have a job. So we need to change that situation. And I think the only way we will do that is by introducing targets and having organisations commit to delivering on those targets. We need examples from government, state and federal government, of doing that.
Dylan Alcott also used his speech to call for better funding for the National Disability Insurance Scheme, which allows people with a disability to live more independently. CEO of Limbs for Life, Melissa Noonan, AM, says the scheme is inadequate for many people.
People who are eligible for the NDIS can access, you know, a raft of products and supports which can help them live independently. But those who are ineligible for NDIS funding or who've missed out because of their age, you know, the gap is huge. Even just for basic supports around the home, obviously, you know, not everyone is a sports person. But having said that, you know, it's the basic daily living needs that where the gap lies.
And more independence, she says, will mean people with a disability are the norm in workplaces rather than an inspiration for able-bodied people.
I might be up at a supermarket or doing some shopping or just going about my business on the weekend and I wear shorts, so I don't, you know, it's obvious that I've got a disability. But, you know, an older person might say to me, you know, I've got a bit of a hip pain this morning and I see you walking around. It encourages me to, you know, keep pushing forward. But I don't think they mean, you know, any offence by that. I really don't. If it can drive them to do something and it creates a positive change, then it doesn't need a title. It doesn't need a label. It can just help to make a difference.
That's Limbs for Life CEO Melissa Noonan there, ending that report from Isabel Rowe. Well, to the pandemic now, major international corporations are ramping up their efforts to better protect people from COVID-19. Vaccine manufacturers Pfizer and BioNTech have begun working and developing a new vaccine to specifically target the Omicron variant. Epidemiologists are cautiously optimistic that Australia may have seen a peak in Omicron cases, but they also warn that it's too early to let our guard down. David Taylor has more.
After 2 years of wrestling with the COVID-19 pandemic, one epidemiologist, Nancy Baxter, says it's clear the road ahead will not be a smooth one.
And as we're seeing from New South Wales, that may well be bumpy.
That's why behind the scenes, major pharmaceutical companies remain in overdrive, developing ways to fight the pandemic. Pfizer and BioNTech say they've started a clinical trial to test a new version of their vaccine specifically designed to target the COVID-19 Omicron variant. That's because Omicron has eluded some of the protection provided by Pfizer's original two-dose vaccine regime. They're also testing a fourth dose of the current vaccine against a fourth dose of the Omicron-based vaccine. Nancy Baxter welcomes the news but says new variants are already emerging.
There's already talk of, the child of Omicron, BA2, which is a variant that is related, closely related to Omicron, that may be more transmissible, and that seems to be spreading in Denmark. You know, just because we've had a lot of Omicron does not mean we're necessarily out of the woods.
And that's clear from the daily case numbers around the country. New South Wales recorded 21,030 new COVID-19 cases in the 24 hours to 8 p.m. yesterday, but down from over 64,000 cases on January 13. In Victoria, there were 13,507 new infections officially reported, down from over 50,000 cases on January 7. 712 new COVID-19 cases have been reported in Tasmania. Queensland's chief health officer says it looks like the Gold Coast has reached a peak, with the rest of southeast Queensland expected in the next week. Epidemiologist Nancy Baxter says nationally, she believes Australia has seen a peak in COVID-19 daily case numbers.
With the Omicron wave, it does look like we're starting to peak and coming to the other side of our curve. But, this COVID happens in waves. It's not something that's predictable. And so we need to kind of be able to adapt to that.
We've got schools returning next week. Are we likely to see case numbers spike in the coming weeks in the wake of that?
Yeah, well, absolutely. We may not see too much of a spike in cases because right now we're not finding cases very well. We're not the testing and tracing where we have a changed our definition of close contacts. So we may not see a huge bump in cases, but we are going to see an increase in transmission.
The question is Australia as well equipped as it can be to live with the virus for the foreseeable future? Dean Whiting is the CEO of Pathology Technology Australia. He told RN Breakfast, millions of rapid antigen tests, which play a vital role in helping close contacts return to work, are set to land on our shores over the coming weeks.
We've got approximately 3 to 5 million tests arriving every week in Australia, and probably around 180 million on order, which will trickle in over the next few weeks, probably not meeting full demand until about March.
But what if we could manufacture rats here in Australia? Sam Lanyon is executive chair of Lumos Diagnostics. It's a Melbourne-based firm, but manufactures rapid antigen tests in the US, not here in Australia. He says the business case to manufacture the tests here in Australia is missing one key ingredient.
A local buy mandate is probably the key thing for me that's missing, and potentially coming. And I think that having a local purchasing mandate where government and departments and health are incentivised to buy Australian, sourced and manufactured product is the key thing that we need to do to build sovereign capability, and we need to be in that position in the future.
That's Lumos Diagnostics Chief Executive Sam Lennon, ending that report from David Taylor. Well, Western leaders are stepping up preparations amid fears of Russian military action in Ukraine. The United States is trying to back up fuel sources for Europe in the event of a conflict with Moscow. And nations, including Australia, are considering further sanctions. But despite Russia's military build-up near the border, some Ukrainians are still trying to remain calm. Gavin Coote reports.
Thousands of Russian troops have been gathering near Ukraine and have been holding military drills. But Moscow has denied it's planning an assault. And while tensions between the two countries have been simmering for at least 8 years, there's uncertainty about what will happen next.
We've been watching it. Ukrainians have been experiencing it for all those years. But of course, right now, we're, you know, dreadfully concerned.
Sonia Mitsak is a leader in Sydney's Ukrainian community and is concerned about Russia's military build-up near the border. Western leaders have reassured Ukraine that any invasion would bring punishing sanctions on Moscow. Russia's ambassador to Australia, Alexei Pavlovsky, has told the ABC sanctions don't work.
By now, everybody should understand that it is not the language which should be used when talking to Russia.
And Alexei Pavlovsky denies there's any aggression on Russia's part.
These troops are not a threat. They are a warning to Ukraine's rulers not to attempt any reckless military adventures.
Australians have been told to leave Ukraine as soon as they can. Sonia Mitsak still has many relatives in Ukraine. One of them is a soldier.
He's now ready to fight again. I spoke to him last night and he told me that he has prepared his wife and children to evacuate if there is a Russian attack. But he will actually stay to defend the city. He'll stay to defend Ukraine.
Do you know of any Ukrainian Australians that have already left following that warning from the Australian government earlier this week?
Look, no, I only know of two who have not left. I think there are about 1,400 Australians in Ukraine at this time. I mean, they're, if not for COVID, there would have been many more, such as even myself and my family, because many Ukrainian Australians, you know, were able to make regular trips there. People will be making their way back because that has been the advice of the Australian government to do so. And so if possible, they probably will. But at the same time, in one way, they're very concerned. In another way, they're not panicking. They're taking things one day at a time. I mean, there is some feeling too in Ukraine there that this is a sort of a bluff and a bullying stance on the part of Putin in order to destabilise the people and actually to psychologically destabilise the population so that they are alert and panicking.
The prospect of conflict with Russia now has Western leaders also thinking about energy security. That's because Russia is the main exporter of liquefied natural gas to Europe. So the United States is in talks with major energy-producing countries and companies over possible backup sources if Russia cuts off supply. US President Joe Biden is again stressing how serious it had become if Moscow moved in on Ukraine.
There will be enormous consequences if he were to go in and invade, as he could, the entire country, or a lot less than that as well. For Russia, not only in terms of economic consequences and political consequences, but it'll be enormous consequences worldwide. This would be the largest, if he were to move in with all those forces, it'd be the largest invasion since World War II. It would change the world.
That's US President Joe Biden ending Gavin Coote's report. On ABC Radio, right across the country, you're listening to The World Today. A pioneering female jockey has been recognised in Australia in today's Australia Day honours list with an Order of Australia medal. Pam O'Neill made history in 1979 when she was granted her jockey's licence, paving the way for other women in the sport. Pam had spent years lobbying racing officials for a chance to ride against the men. She ended up riding a treble, 3 wins on her first day. Pam got her jockey's licence at the age of 34 and rode until her 50s. She's now retired in Queensland, where she's celebrating her Australia Day honour.
Well, I'm very thrilled and I feel very humble about it because, Sally, it was at the time that I wanted to do it. I really wanted to riot against the men, and I couldn't see why we couldn't. It was really like a discrimination against women, you know? So I feel lovely to be recognised by my peers. I really do.
How strong was the discrimination against women at racetracks in Australia? Were there areas that you weren't even allowed to go into? Is that right?
Yeah, that was right, Sally. There were certain parts in the stands where women couldn't go into. So it was really a discrimination against women. But I grew up in Ascot, where there was 32 stables, and Eagle Farm and Doomben was just a stone throw from where I lived. I started off in pony clubs, but I didn't think that was fast enough, and I wanted to get on the racehorse. So that's where it all come from.
What kind of things did you have to go through to be able to ride in terms of doing barrier trials and things like that?
Well, because I'd been riding all over Australia, and they made me do 10 barrier trials, so I did it all in one day. I thought, I'm determined, I want to get going, so I did them all in one day, and then they granted me my licence.
When you finally got the news that you were able to ride as a fully-fledged jockey, what did that feel like for you? What was your reaction, Pam?
My reaction was, geez, I've been shooting my mouth off for years. Here it comes. And I was thrilled that I accomplished that I could ride against the men.
And I understand there were no changing facilities. There was a caravan that was nicknamed Pam's Penthouse. Is that right?
Yes. My rides were down the Gold Coast anyhow because there was no changing facilities. But I would have got changed in the middle of the enclosure as long as I could ride. Anyhow, they had a caravan there and they called it Pam's Penthouse. So I felt quite special that day. But a couple of years I was getting changed in the doctor's rooms, and that was my changing room.
What do you think now, Pam, watching some of the female jockeys? Obviously, Michelle Payne made history in the Melbourne Cup. Well, what do you think when you watch them out there doing it now?
Oh, I think it's great, and it's something they want to do. And you've got to remember too, Sally, in 1979, I come in on equal terms and equal pay. And I look now at a lot of the girls in the sport, like cricket and football and that, and they're still fighting for their rights and fighting for their money. So, you know, like we broke the mold.
Do you think there's still a long way to go?
Well, I think in particular in certain events, but it's starting to take off now, and I think, you know, the girl footballers and cricketers should be pretty close to the same money as what the men are getting. You know, I don't think they're doing the job and they're entertaining and crowds are getting there. They've just got to, I think they've got the publicity and everything's got to get behind them a lot more.
What do you think this whole experience has taught you, fighting for your place in racing and then taking up that place? So what did you learn from the whole thing, Pam?
Well, if anybody can tell you that I'm one of those people that if I set my mind to something, I always want to achieve it. I love racing. I've always loved the industry, and the more I can do for the industry and help it make it better, I will. And it's just taught me that if you want to do something, you keep at it long enough and you will achieve it.
She's fantastic. A force of nature. Pam O'Neill, pioneering jockey who's been awarded an Order of Australia medal today. Well, dozens of scientists have also been recognised in today's Australia Day honours. But turning their ideas into practice takes money, and science advocates say much more funding is needed. Brett Burney reports.
Professor Mark Hutchinson is an Adelaide-based scientist who's leading the development of a range of scientific breakthroughs. The latest...
The world's smallest microscope in a needle is currently being developed for brain surgery to make brain surgery safer and faster.
He says Australian scientists have plenty more potential breakthroughs and advancements to offer, but getting them from pen and paper and into a lab where they can be trialled and tested often doesn't happen because there's not enough funding available. Misha Schubert is the CEO of Science and Technology Australia, where Mark Hutchinson is also president.
We do have a challenge in our economy where what's called the Valley of Death, which is where people have a great idea, something that could turn into a terrific product. But we have particular challenges because of the size of our economy, particularly with turning more of them into fully engineered prototypes and products.
Science and Technology Australia has released its budget submission to the federal government. It wants a $2.4 billion translation fund established to save more pioneering ideas from ending up in that so-called Valley of Death.
So the idea of a research translation fund would take more great Australian science and turn it into products and jobs and companies to help secure Australia's economic future. It would get more of our great science across that valley of death in the development phase and really make the most of this terrific asset we have as a country.
Among those assets would be jobs, Professor Mark Hutchinson says, and the ability for Australia to establish its own supply chains for things like mRNA vaccines.
That will reap massive rewards for Australia, for Australians, and for the economy, because when we talk about investing that scale of money, it is not simply a half-baked concept. This is a well-trod path that other international economies have taken to kickstart their manufacturing.
And Misha Schubert says it goes even further than that.
You know, the lessons of the last few years are really clear, both for our economy and for managing people's health and safety, which is that, you know, we really have to invest deeply in science and scientists because their success is crucial to our safety. And we should fund science like our lives and the economy depend on it, because they do.
The ABC has approached the Treasurer Josh Frydenberg's office for comment, asking if it's considering Science and Technology Australia's submission.
That's Rhett Burney reporting. Well, around 46,000 Australian children live in out-of-home care, looked after by foster families, kinship carers or the state. But what happens when they leave care? Some states and territories have extended care beyond the age of 18, but others are lagging behind. Dale Drinkwater reports.
Turning 18 is a pretty fun time for most young people, but for those living in out-of-home care, it can be a terrifying prospect.
I was more concerned that a lot of the supports I'd come to rely on would crumble underneath me.
Matthew Krishna lives in New South Wales, where support for living in out-of-home care ends when you turn 18. For him, that was 6 months ago.
I remember saying to my caseworker that it felt like I was sort of being pushed off a cliff into adulthood, and I didn't really have a grasp or understanding of how to get my life together.
Matthew Krishna has lived in 8 different out-of-home care placements since he was 14. That's a mix of foster homes, group homes, and independent living. Over a 6-month period, he was in and out of hotels. He says that has a lot to do with why, at his age, he's only just entering his final year of his higher school certificate.
I had been through 6 different high schools because of the amount of different placements I had gone through. And I've actually had to restart year 11 3 times now.
A group of advocacy organisations known as Home Stretch have long campaigned to provide some kind of stability for people like Matthew by asking states and territories to fully fund care until the age of 21. Some states accepted that request, but New South Wales has made no commitment to do so, and Queensland's care ends after 19 years old. Stepping Stones House has been part of the campaign, and its chair is Simon Bird.
30% of these youngsters are jobless when they turn 18, and 30% of them are homeless within 12 months of turning 18.
Stepping Stones House provides accommodation and other supports to children in New South Wales until the age of 24.
We're helping them provide a stable home environment while they go through whether it's TAFE or university to get a qualification and settle down in long-term employment.
A national framework for protecting Australia's children was released by the Federal Department of Social Services in December last year. It recognised how vulnerable young people are when leaving out-of-home care, saying they are 4 times more likely to stay on income support payments compared to others their age. The New South Wales Department of Communities and Justice did not respond to the ABC's direct questions about plans to extend financial support for carers until the age of 21, but it did say it's committed to helping young people feel safe, confident and adequately supported. In a statement, a spokesperson for the department said,
support available to care leavers includes personalised plans and aftercare assistance, including financial assistance to support education, training and employment goals, health and wellbeing, counselling and other specialist services.
Matthew Krishna says his financial leaving care plan didn't include the things he needed for life aftercare.
The only thing that had been approved was funding for counselling.
And he worries his experience is part of a wider problem that could be solved easily.
At the moment, it's very discretionary, and that sort of discretion between case plans causes some real instability within the out-of-home care system.
That's Matthew Krishna ending that report from Dale Drinkwater. That's all from the World Today team for today. Join us again at the same time tomorrow. I'm Sally Sara. Stay safe.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.